Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon.
And welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Our guest today is Jaime Martinez, the community defense organizer at Casa San Jose. First question, Jaime, is what is Casa San Jose?
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be speaking to folks on the radio. Casa San Jose is a resource center for the Latino community here in southwestern Pennsylvania. We were actually founded in 2013 by a sister of St. Joseph, Sister Janice Vanderneck. It began with her seeing that a community was under-resourced and there was no real space in the community to be addressing those needs. So she said, yes, I want to do something, and started finding solutions. Put her ear to the ground with two other people in the basement of a Lutheran church and figuring out what folks need and delivering solutions. Since then, 12 years later, we have expanded to over 35 employees. We have social workers. We have an organizing and advocacy program. And we have really established ourselves as the go-to source of support for underserved Latinos in the community.
You now serve, I think, around 6,000 people a year?
Yeah, that's right.
And what kinds of things do you do for them?
So that's anything from I need help with groceries, I don't know how I'm going to make rent, to I need to get my child a passport. All of those kinds of services we are really good with. We have also been good with connecting folks to legal services, helping them to develop sustainable solutions to any financial issues they may have and working through that with them. And beyond that, in the time that we find ourselves in now, we are working on community defense, which is kind of where I come in, right? We've seen the news. We've seen how the Latino community and the immigrant community at large is being scapegoated, is being demoralized, and we are at the forefront of making sure that folks' rights are protected, that we are engaging and organizing the community in a way that celebrates and includes our immigrant community and trying to build power.
So I know Casa San Jose runs Know Your Rights sessions for immigrants to the United States.
So Know Your Rights sessions are what happens if you have an interaction with law enforcement? What happens if immigration enforcement shows up at your house, at your workplace, or stops you in your car, or stops you in public? What can you expect? What do they look like? How can you respond? These are the kinds of sessions that we've been having all across Southwest PA over the past 4 months, basically. We've had over 50 sessions since the beginning of the year, and we've served more than 800 people.
So if ICE comes knocking on somebody's door, what should they do?
A few things on that. At large, I think a common refrain that I use that folks should internalize is that ICE preys on the ignorant and the isolated. Folks that are walking alone, that are walking to work alone, that live alone, or that drive alone, that don't have support networks in the community, that are isolated from their community. That's a prime target for ICE, because they know that if they grab that person, if they abduct that person, because that's what's happening, no one will know that they're gone. And that's better for them, because it'll grind down the person's humanity and make them more likely to sign deportation papers once they're in detention. ICE will prey on ignorant folks, folks that don't know their rights. They will show up in packs. They will always outnumber the people that they are looking for. We've seen an average of like 4 to 7 agents showing up to an interaction looking for one person, and that's for one person. We have seen as many as 17 agents showing up to a single family home, all of them armed, one of them with an AR-15. So they will look to be aggressive, provoke, intimidate, manipulate, and they will try to get into your house. So what's really important, going back to your question, is you should never open the door. You should ask them through the door to identify themselves. That's full name, badge number, what agency they're with, why they're there. And then if they want to get in, if they want to talk to you, they need a judicial warrant. Tell them, I need to see a signed warrant by a judge. If they don't have that, you should not open that door and implicitly give them access into your home. If they do make it into your home, if you do open the door for some reason, very important that you speak the words, I do not consent to this. I do not consent to this search. I do not consent to you being in my home right now. That's a key legal phrase that kind of harkens back to the Fourth Amendment, the right to refuse unreasonable searches or seizures. Exactly. Right. That's right. So you got to tell folks, I do not consent. And that Fourth Amendment protection is strongest in the home. And you should not let them in without a warrant signed by a judge.
Sounds like people from other countries legally do have rights in the United States.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just had a great conversation with a lawyer from the ACLU about this yesterday out in Philadelphia. When it comes to things like the First Amendment, we were talking more about the context of people protesting and their rights with the First Amendment. It's not completely settled as to whether non-citizens have like the full breadth of First Amendment rights. Many courts have established that that is the case, that if you are here in the U.S., if you are on American soil, you have access to those constitutional rights, and those are very broad. But President Trump has appointed many judges that may have different opinions, and these cases haven't been tested too much. So we might see a new flurry of cases coming to a different set of judges in this era that might give us different responses. But broadly speaking, we should act as if, yes, we do have those protections and hope for the best.
Sounds like what you're saying is prior to 2025, case law had established the precedent that foreign nationals in this country legally were also protected by the United States Constitution, but now...
Right. So, yes, that's right. Like, it's, how would I put it? Everybody who is on American soil, documented or undocumented, regardless of legal status, has access to these rights. Now, what we're seeing on the news, on tape, here in Pittsburgh, is that what is our rights on paper, what are our rights on paper, and what is actually being respected in a situation are two very different things. We can have a whole conversation about what the law says and what we should do, and then there's what is actually happening and what you should do in response to what is actually happening. So that's another kind of situation as well.
What should an immigrant do if confronted by people in ice vests on the street as they're getting out of their car and walking into their apartment?
What we've been seeing is the likeliest scenarios, at least here in southwestern Pennsylvania, is ICE showing up in the parking lots of businesses, being out in public. And so somebody will be driving into work, and then when they park their car, like it'll be like a restaurant, when they park their car, suddenly four unmarked police vehicles come out of nowhere and block the car from leaving. And then six officers come out and swarm the car. Just a few weeks ago, a 22-year-old guy gets grabbed out of the car, thrown on the ground. We believe he might have been tased, and then is put in handcuffs before he is asked to produce identification, all with his partner in the passenger seat. So that's the kind of thing that we're seeing. They're in public. They are waiting outside of places that they think people that they're looking for will be at. And so they're not going into the restaurants and asking for folks. They're waiting outside and waiting for folks to leave work alone, folks to show up in the early morning, or they'll be waiting outside people's homes as they leave to go to school, to work, etc. If you're confronted by them, number one, it's always important to have a buddy with you. If you feel unsafe, if you feel that you are prone to being targeted, having a buddy with you is important. Additionally, you're going to want to, again, ask them for full name, badge number, what agency they're from. Do they have a warrant?
It's more like, may I see your warrant?
Yes, correct. Well, sometimes they don't have a warrant, right? And they'll just, they'll say they do, but then they never show a paper. So trying to take a picture of the warrant, trying to get somebody to see that something is happening to you, stating your name to someone, all of that stuff. We want somebody else to know that you are being abducted by ICE. Because what we've seen a lot is somebody gets picked up in the dead of night. No one knows for 3 days where the person is. And then somebody at work will start asking questions like, hey, they're not showing up to work anymore. I wonder what happened. And then it becomes a passing thought. And then suddenly folks are forgotten about. We don't want that. No person in our city should be forgotten about. We want to hold each other accountable as good neighbors. So we want to make sure that if someone's detained, we know that they've been detained.
You used a loaded word there, abducted. But that is, I guess, what you're saying is happening if there's not a warrant being shown.
Yeah. So I want to maybe provide a little bit of color to our listeners. ICE does not show up like a police officer with a friendly knock at the door and say, hey, like, we're here to detain you because you did this and that. That is not what's going on. What we're seeing instead are folks in hoods and masks. They are masked, like with ski masks, black ski masks, wearing all black or wearing like camo, showing up to houses while it's still dark outside, before dawn, furiously knocking on doors, trying to batter down doors, and asking for somebody to come out. They will not say who they are a lot of the time. They will not identify themselves. We have specifically heard that some ICE agents will say, I don't want to identify myself because I don't want to get doxxed. That's the kind of scenario that we're seeing. They're not identifying themselves. They are not saying that they are immigration enforcement. They will call themselves the police when they are not the police. They'll say they're investigating a criminal matter. Sometimes they're recently here in Allegheny County, we've seen that they are posing as CYF, child, youth, and family workers, saying that they want to do a welfare check on an unaccompanied minor and then ask the sponsor for their documents and then arrest the sponsor. That's the sort of thing that we've been seeing. And then they will grab somebody. I mean, we've all seen the videos. They pick somebody off the street. They pick somebody from their front door. They will become aggressive. When they ask for why are you arresting this person? Why is this going on? We're arresting them for immigration. I'm sorry, what the heck does that mean, to be arresting somebody for immigration? That makes no sense. They take them to the ICE processing office at 3000 Sydney Street on the south side, and then they will book them as if they were in a carceral system, take their picture, take their fingerprints, interview them as to who they are and identify them. And then because we have a team of attorneys that will go down and try to make contact with these folks, we will get stonewalled by ICE agents. An attorney will go down and say, I need to speak to my client. They'll say, oh, we haven't identified if they're here or not yet. And they know damn well that they're there, but they say, oh, we can't tell if they're here or not. Come back later. It's going to take hours to identify them. A few minutes later, we'll get a call from the person who's in that office detained to their family saying, hey, I'm here. Like, I'm okay. That family will call us and say, hey, like, I can confirm that they're there. By the time we're back there, oh, I'm sorry, we already transferred them out of this office. They're in a detention facility now. They go to a detention facility in rural Pennsylvania, Moshannon Valley Processing Center. It's a private for-profit prison is what it is. It used to be a private for-profit federal prison, and then they reskinned it as an ICE detention facility when President Biden signed an executive order banning the renewal of these contracts. ICE pays the GEO group, which runs this place, $3 million per month base pay. Then on top of that, a per head daily rate. You have folks being detained for having or not having a piece of paper, being forced upon them self-deportation papers, keeping them in detention cells, not letting them be with their friends and family. They are not a danger to society. They do not have criminal records. They've been here for sometimes decades. They are members of the community, workers, taxpayers, mothers and fathers, families. And, you know, rich people profit and rich people get richer. And the American promise is desecrated.
We are talking with Jaime Martinez, the community defense organizer at Casa San Jose. Is this a new situation? Has it really been escalated in the last year where people are targeted? And are they targeting specific groups? Is it just Latinos?
I think it's important to realize that this did not start on January 20th, 2025. This was happening during the presidency of Barack Obama. This is a bipartisan issue in the worst way possible. And no one seems to want to do anything about it. We've had many, many situations where the American public and the American political system has had the opportunity to fix what is very obviously a flawed immigration system that has only become extremely flawed as of recent. When the Italians were coming in, when the Irish were coming in, you know, it was open, Ellis Island. They were greeted by the Statue of Liberty, and there was no visa system. There was no backlog of 5 years and H-1B visas. You were on a boat and you got in and you were healthy enough and they would maybe change your name to make it a bit more American, and you'd just be here, and you'd be an immigrant, right, because of your life story, but you would be here, and you'd have the chance to start a new life. That doesn't happen anymore. And the last time we had this sort of mass migration was 100 years ago. We know very well that as times change, so do our systems. And our system is not caught up for the way that the world works and the way that the transit of people work, how people move and migrate across the world. And folks have always known, we have created, as Americans, the American myth of becoming a melting pot, of diversity being our biggest strength, of immigrants being welcomed from everywhere. But the reality is that right now, that's not been the case. That's not been the case for a decade. And what we're seeing now is just the scab being ripped off. The Trump administration, Trump 2.0, is moving a bit quicker than the past presidencies have, but it's mostly a continuation and just an expansion. We've had many opportunities to do something. We haven't. We have been slipping further and further and further into authoritarianism, and we have permitted our country to get to this point. Let's remember that President Trump won this election, and his campaign was very explicitly mass deportations now. I think back very vividly to the picture of thousands of people holding mass deportations now signs. That platform won, whether we like it or not. So something within ourselves as a voting population as well, and as Americans in this country, is deeply flawed in our ability to find compassion and humanity within the immigrant community and within just people that don't look like us or think like us or speak like us. So I think it speaks to a broader compulsion that we need to kind of root out of ourselves in this moment, and we need to stand up and do something.
Of all the things that Mr. Trump promised during his reelection campaign, the immigration issue is the only thing where he's still polling positively, which speaks to, in my opinion, a problem with, you know, American society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a lack of education. I think we're all so deep in our algorithms on social media. We're in our echo chambers online. The news that we're reading and listening to, it's all very tailored to what we already believe. And then I also think with the decline of religiosity and the decline of third spaces, where we meet people that have different political opinions but also share common ground in other respects, the lack of those spaces and the decline of these spaces has created a world where polarization is the inevitable conclusion. And that has created a lot of blind spots within ourselves, within the people that live across from us, that live in a completely different universe, and that think that they are only picking up the rapists and drug traffickers and criminals or whatever and justify it like that. So I think there's a twofold issue here. One, we need to educate ourselves properly. The best way to do that is through relationship, right? It means getting involved. It means doing something. At CASA, we have many, many ways for folks to get involved. When you are able to witness firsthand the injustices that are taking place in our city, in our community, in our country, that is a radicalizing force. And I use that word radicalization very sparingly, but I think it's important to say it because it changes the way, it's transformative. It changes the way that you think about the issue, and it urges you to act. The second half of this is we need to come together as a community, and we need to learn from each other, and we need to learn primarily from the folks we disagree with. I know it is so hard for folks to talk to folks across the aisle. It is so hard for us to withstand the uncle at Thanksgiving that just kind of spews whatever he sees on Newsmax, right? But if we don't reach these people at our kitchen tables, at dinner, at church, in walking out of our classrooms, in the late night dorm room conversations, we are never going to be able to change the way that our society is functioning. The antidote to all of this distortion of reality is human relationship. Humanity is our greatest strength. It is what makes us unique and beautiful. We have to play to our strengths. We have to see people as they are and lift us up together.
I'm thinking about my time teaching English as a second language to people from, you know, ranging from refugees from Iran to students from Malaysia, from different parts of Africa, different parts of Europe. And it was so invigorating to learn more about the world by talking to people who come from a different place than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the beauty of Pittsburgh and our city as well is that there is no real boundary to the kinds of folks that you're going to meet in your neighborhood. If you knock the doors on your surrounding three blocks over the course of a weekend, for example, just to introduce yourself, imagine the kinds of people that you would meet, the stories that people have. If you invited folks over for dinner one day, you might disagree on some things, but you will agree on so much more because we have so much more in common than what separates us. But we don't do that anymore. We are sticking our heads in the sand because of technology and big tech, and you know, it's not sticking our head in the sand, it's sticking our head into our screen, right? We need to return to our humanity, as you said, talk to folks that are different than us, find joy in what may seemingly separate us, but is what makes us unique. We have to celebrate these things. And we also have to stand up for those that are being actively marginalized right now, right? There's a lot to learn in the marginalized and the oppressed. So we have a responsibility, not just as Americans, not just as Yinzers, not just as CMU affiliates, but as human beings, to dig deep into that work.
It's always easier for people to point the finger at those who are different and view them as a threat. I don't know if you were even alive then when the Tea Party got started.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of their tricks, was to point at other people and say it's all their fault, while they kept funneling more money into more and more corporate pockets. I wonder how much of this crisis that immigrants are facing now in this country relates to that, that people have branded them as the problem, and so more people are tolerating what is going on with the immigration control.
Yeah, I would agree with that. People are also very busy, to add on to what you're saying. We do not live human-paced life, because how many times does your phone ring in the course of an hour or buzz? Me, probably like 50 times an hour. I'll get a little ding, buzz. I'll get a phone call, text message, news notification. There's things constantly happening. And so we become so distracted by what's happening around us and what's happening on our phones and what's happening in life that we forget to deal with looking up and looking around us and looking at our neighbors and investing in the work of our neighborhood. I think everything has to be extremely local. We freak out. Our heads are constantly on fire because of what we see on the news. I mean, Washington, D.C. is like new headline every day, and it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Every hour.
Right. Exactly. And that is a distraction from the broader issues that are right here in your neighborhood that you can directly impact. You cannot make any sort of impact on a conversation that the president of the United States has with the president of El Salvador right now. You can't. Unreachable. How are you going to get into the Oval Office? But you know what you can do? Respond to a call that ICE is in your neighborhood and record them and ask them why they're there and ask them to leave. That is something that you can do that will actually save families from being separated, that will prove to your neighbors that you care about them, that does the work of protecting the immigrant community, but that also does the deeper work, drawing from that well of human relationship. It's the work of community building, right? Showing folks around you that you care about them, investing in them, and that will ultimately solve a lot of the broader issues that we see in society. But it starts block by block.
We are talking with Jaime Martinez from Casa San Jose, where he holds the title of Community Defense Organizer. I am just curious what your reaction is to what's going on in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was deported from Maryland, even though he's here legally.
Well, it's terrifying, right? I was recently speaking at a teach-in, and something that they said was that human rights don't trickle down, they rise up. Great, great phrase. Human rights don't trickle down, they rise up. What that means is if one person in a room does not have the same rights that you do, in essence, it's not really a right. And if it can happen to somebody, it can absolutely happen to you. So let's think about the lack of due process. Let's think about the family that is being affected. I mean, that prison in El Salvador,
it's brutal.
It's brutal, absolutely. And they gloat about how they are never going to get these folks out and about how they torture them. Like, we're in really, really, really bad territory. And now for the president to be talking about how we should be exporting American citizens to that prison as well. I mean, it's just a complete lack of care for the folks that are in this country and also for the humanity that is within each of us and the way we should be treating one another as human beings. So it's terrifying, but this is a red line. This is one of these moments, right, where the American public can say, I'm okay with this or I'm not okay with this. We have failed on this so many times. We have failed to say, I'm not okay with this and actually done something. This is another one of these moments. Are we going to do something or are we just going to say, wow, this makes me so mad and then move on to the next story? That's the choice that each of us has.
Casa San Jose, are there other agencies like yours in the greater Pittsburgh area that can help foreign nationals and immigrants out when they run into situations with ICE?
We primarily serve the Latino community, but given just the nature of the situation, what's been going on, we've created a really robust rapid response network within Allegheny County and 20 minutes beyond county lines as of now. That might grow because we've been getting a great response. One thing I would encourage folks to do, broadly speaking, is we have a 24/7 ICE hotline. This is if you hear that anything's happening on campus, if you hear that anything's happening around the city, this is rumor, eyewitness. You saw something on social media. You heard something. You are being affected yourself. They're outside your door. Anything like that, call us. That number is 412-736-7167. Again, 412-736-7167. That number works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we dispatch trained rapid response team members to go out to a situation. We can get there within 20 minutes as of now. We're working to bring that down as more and more folks get onboarded. And we view what's happening. We record. We ask for details. We make sure that we have names and information of people that have been detained. And we have attorneys ready to activate and go down to the ICE office. It's very robust. So when it comes to immediately what happens to you if you get stopped by ICE, Casa San Jose kind of has the niche of being the rapid response that goes out. Now, beyond that, if you have questions about immigration law or like you need legal services or immigration services, any of that sort of stuff, JFCS, which is Jewish Family and Community Services, great resource right here in Squirrel Hill, I believe. And they are great partners and dear friends to CASA. Somebody else I can think of off the top of my head, the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh has been very active when it comes to especially like the Muslim community. And we've seen what's been going on with the Muslim community and like the intersection with the pro-Palestine protesters that have been abducted, all of that sort of stuff. Oh, you can also research what's known as PIFUP. PIFUP is more on the legal end, but it's an initiative to provide like a public defender, in essence, to a person in deportation defense and removal proceedings. Currently, anyone who is in immigration court gets to have an attorney, but at their personal cost. So it's not like most of the time folks don't have an attorney because they can't afford one. PIFUP is the initiative to expand representation to everybody in immigration court, to create like a public defender's office for immigrants when they face these removal proceedings in immigration court. So you can kind of ask them. They have funding and resources to be able to solicit representation and counsel for you if you are in a situation. PERC is the Pennsylvania Immigrant and Refugee Coalition, I believe. They're also a great resource. All in all, there's a lot of different folks doing the work around here. Hello Neighbor is a refugee service here in Pittsburgh as well. Lots of great folks at the table doing a lot of good work and committed to the good fight.
I like that name, Hello Neighbor, mm-hmm. because to my worldview, that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
You're my neighbor. Everyone's my neighbor.
That's exactly right.
I don't care if they're wearing a hijab or speaking Spanish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's think about this. Like, especially in this neighborhood is where Fred Rogers taught us all to be good neighbors, right? He recorded just down the street and he taught us how to be good neighbors. He talked about what it means to be kind to one another, how to show up for one another. That's his legacy that he left in this city. That's the legacy that we all need to pick up right now in a moment so crucial as this one.
I'm Jaime Martinez from Casa San Jose. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Now, at the time, of course, that coup seemed like a complete success. At relatively low cost, the United States had overthrown a government that it didn't like and brought back the Shah, who was obviously now prepared to do America's bidding. It was a perfect success, or so it seemed at the time. It is only now, from the perspective of 50 years, that we are able to look back and see the horrific long-term consequences that this apparent success actually produced for us.
That's Stephen Kinzer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Kinzer on Iran, the 1953 American coup, and the end of democracy. Regime change started decades ago. The new term is just a change of clothes. Dwight Eisenhower was president when the United States overthrew the popular democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. What was Mossadegh's transgression? He wanted Iran's oil to benefit the Iranian people. The coup brought the Shah back from exile and put him on the peacock throne. What ensued was 25 years of tyranny and repression, culminating in Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic Revolution. The coup in Iran was one of the pivotal events of the 20th century. Virtually all Iranians know about it, yet most Americans haven't even heard of it. The U.S. professes that it supports democracy in the Middle East, yet when there was a democratic government in Iran, the U.S. destroyed it. Here to tell the story of those events is Stephen Kinzer. He's a veteran New York Times correspondent. He's co-author of Bitter Fruit and author of Crescent and Star. His latest book, A Times Notable Book of the Year, is on the 1953 coup in Iran and is called All the Shah's Men. Stephen Kinzer spoke at the Pacifica Asia Museum in Pasadena, California, in mid-September 2003.
It was August 19th, 1953. The CIA overthrew a government for the first time. It's hard for us to imagine, knowing what we know about regime change and covert action in the CIA now, that there was a time when the CIA was not thought of as an organization that should be involved in overthrowing regimes, that it should have only been an intelligence agency supposed to provide information for the foreign policy organs of the United States. This coup set the United States off on the path of covert action and regime change. And every government that we have overthrown or tried to overthrow in the 50 years since then has been the victim of a process that began with the intervention of 1953 in Iran. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the background of this operation and then how it was carried out and what its effects have been, because there is no better lesson in the 20th century history of the United States, and I say this as one who has immersed myself in this history, that teaches us so clearly about the unintended long-term effects of our interventions abroad than this operation. I wrote this book with the idea that I was going to tell a story that on the one hand was profoundly important in shaping the history of the United States, the history of Iran, and really the history of the world, but an episode that has been largely forgotten. Really, most Americans and most people in the world, even those that are interested in international affairs, have only the vaguest idea that this thing ever happened. much less that it had such a profound effect on shaping the whole Cold War and post-Cold War world. But as I was writing it, I slowly took on what I thought was a complementary but somewhat different mission. I realized that I wasn't just telling the story of a particular episode that was very important but had been lost to history. But in addition to that, I was resurrecting the figure of a man who in the mid-20th century was one of the most famous, most debated, most controversial, most fascinating, most interesting people in the world, but who today is almost completely unknown. And that is Mohammad Mossadegh, the nationalist leader who was the victim of the 1953 coup. In the mid-century, Mossadegh shook the world and challenged the system that had dominated the world for centuries. And in 1951, in recognition of his huge impact on the world, Time magazine named Mohammad Mossadegh as its Man of the Year, which meant that in the first issue of Time magazine in January of 1952, Mossadegh appeared on the cover of Time magazine. Actually, he beat out for the honor of Man of the Year 1951 Douglas MacArthur, Winston Churchill, Dwight Eisenhower, and Harry Truman. And in those days, Time magazine was actually making good choices. Mossadegh was more important in that year than any of those great figures with whom we are today so familiar. Mohammad Mossadegh was truly a unique and original historical figure. By the time he came to power in 1951, Mossadegh was already elderly. He had had a political career in the 1920s and 30s, but when the dictatorship of Reza Shah emerged, he was excluded from parliament. He went back to his village. Most people assumed that his political life was over, and I believe he assumed that himself. He had no idea that he would ever come back. But decades later, really, Iran became a democracy. Reza Shah was overthrown. He was sent off to exile in South Africa. And Iran resumed its march toward democracy. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, the ideology of nationalism, of anti-colonialism, was surging through the developing world. All the countries of Asia, Latin America, and Africa were looking at the structures that dominated them in ways they had never examined these structures before. Now, bear in mind, this was a time when the voice of poor countries had really never been raised in the councils of the great powers. This was a period before Castro and Nkrumah and Nasser and Sukarno. Mossadegh was treading completely new territory. Nobody had ever done what he did. Mossadegh had two great principles. His entire political career was shaped by two ideas. The first idea was democracy. Mossadegh was a very sophisticated intellectual. He actually came from the royal family that had ruled Iran for several centuries up until the beginning of the 20th century. He was educated in France and Switzerland. He spoke fluent French, which was the language he used in his international travels. And when he emerged as a political figure in the late 1940s in Iran, he had the idea that he would try to bring Iran onto the path of democracy. In fact, as I will point out later on, his embrace of democracy was so profound and so deep and so sincere that it really bordered on the naive. He was so willing to tolerate opposition that he didn't even want to crack down when the CIA and other enemies in the pay of foreign forces were demonstrating and protesting and arranging his overthrow. So democracy was his first platform. His other great dream was to establish Iranian control over Iran. Now, from the perspective of today, this doesn't sound so radical. But looking at the history of Iran, this was as dramatic a change as that country could ever have contemplated. Iran had always been a country, or for centuries before Mossadegh came to power, that had been divided between Russian influence and British influence. After the Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin actually made a wonderful gesture to Iran. He canceled all the debts that Iran had accumulated to Russia during the Tsarist years. And Russia more or less withdrew its influence from Iran. Therefore, Britain was the principal colonial power there. And Britain exercised its power not just by manipulating politics, imposing prime ministers, deposing those that it didn't like, but Britain also had a much more important lever. The most powerful, richest, and largest British enterprise in the entire world was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. This company, through the expedient of bribing Iranian negotiators in the early years of the 20th century, had achieved a fantastically lucrative monopoly on the extraction of Iranian oil. Winston Churchill, as the first Lord of the Admiralty in the early part of the 20th century, was the one who pushed this along with a number of other British leaders. Winston Churchill knew as World War I was breaking out that oil was going to determine who was going to win this war. That oil, not coal, was going to start powering warships. But Britain had no oil, and no country that Britain controlled, and no British colony produced any oil. When Churchill realized the scope of what was available in Iran and saw the terms by which Britain was now going to be able to extract all that oil, use it for the British Navy, to raise the standard of living in Britain, and then to earn huge amounts of foreign exchange from the sale of oil all over the world, he described it in a wonderful phrase as a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. That was what Iranian oil was for Britain. And as I realized in researching this book, Britain would never have been able to play the role that it played in the world during the 1920s and 30s and 40s had it not been for the fantastic wealth that it sucked from under the deserts of Iran. Therefore, when Mossadegh arrived on the political scene with the platform of nationalism, which inevitably to every Iranian meant taking back our oil, he posed a profound challenge to what was then the governing world system and the system that had existed almost without challenge, literally for centuries. Actually, the way Mossadegh came to become prime minister is a fascinating story. Iran was a parliamentary democracy at that time, meaning that the parliament, elected by the people, would choose the prime minister from among its own members. At this time, the system was that the Shah, who was, according to the Constitution, supposed to rule as a constitutional monarch, like the Queen of England, would nominate a candidate for prime minister, and the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, would debate and decide whether this member of parliament was the right person to become prime minister. Well, the Shah in 1951 had appointed one loyal, faithful member of parliament to become prime minister, and the parliament had to debate his nomination. Everyone expected that the first speaker would be Mossadegh, and that he would stand up and condemn this nominee as another lackey of the British, and another turncoat, another traitor to Iran, who didn't want democracy or freedom or self-determination. But Mossadegh didn't stand up. When the debate began, he remained seated, made no effort to make a talk. Another member of parliament stood up. I discovered during my research that he happened to have been on the payroll of the British intelligence service at this time. And this is what he said in his speech. He didn't speak about the nominee for prime minister at all. He spoke about the one person who was the most dominant, most forceful figure in all of Iranian politics. That was Mossadegh. And he pointed to him and said, "You are just one of those windbags who always protests, always criticizes from the outside, and never wants to take any responsibility. You are the example of what is wrong with our country and every developing country. All you want to do is criticize when people like the British are actually producing money, enterprises, and starting the kinds of businesses that make countries productive. You are the example of everything that is wrong with Iran. If you would become prime minister, you would see how difficult it is to deal with the whole world and all of Iran's problems. But you don't want to do that. You only want to criticize, as you have been doing ever since you were elected." This deputy then sat down, and another period of silence fell over the Majlis. Mossadegh then rose slowly from his chair. He took the microphone and said, "Thank you so much for the confidence you have expressed in me by nominating me for prime minister, and I accept." The entire parliament went into pandemonium. Within 1 hour, Mossadegh had been elected prime minister of Iran. Sensing the power that he had at that moment, he came back to the microphone and said, "I've decided there's one condition to my accepting the post. Before I accept, I want the Majlis to approve this bill I have proposed mandating the nationalization of the Anglo-Iranian oil company." That bill was passed immediately. And the next day, Mossadegh became prime minister with the unanimous vote of parliament in favor of his resolution to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company. Now, the process by which he hoped to nationalize it was very interesting. He went to the British and told them, "We're nationalizing your oil company, and we're going to do it according to British law." At this moment, remember, Britain was nationalizing its own strategic industries. They nationalized the coal industry, the steel industry, the transport industry. And the law by which these nationalizations were carried out was very complicated. It allowed both parties, the nationalizer and the one being nationalized, to present their claims for how much money they had spent and how much money they believed they were owed. And it provided for a process by which these claims would be weighed, and it would be decided who owed who money and how much it would be. So Mossadegh really, very cleverly, embraced what was at that time British law. He didn't realize that, in the words of one British official, I quote in my book, "Socialism is all right back home, but out here you have to have a strong hand." Now, how did the British react to this profound, really earth-shattering challenge to their hegemony in Iran? First, they reacted with disbelief. This had never happened before, and the British could not believe that some elderly lunatic, that was Churchill's description of Mossadegh, in a bizarre, faraway country, which is the way the British government perceived Iran, would have the temerity to stand up and propose such a preposterous suggestion. They thought that Mossadegh was just blackmailing them and he wanted to get a few extra million, just like corrupt leaders in the past had done. But it soon became clear to the British that Mossadegh was in deadly earnest and that the enormous majority of the Iranian people supported him. There had never, in the modern history of Iran, been any political program that had been so fervently and passionately supported by the Iranian people as the nationalization of the oil company. So soon the British understood that this was a very serious challenge. So how did they respond? Very simple, according to their long experience in the world, they decided, we will invade Iran and take back the oil fields. They actually produced two different invasion plans. One was to take over all of Iran, and the other was to take over just the oil fields and their refinery. The British had built the world's largest refinery at Abadan in the Persian Gulf. Well, as the plans were underway, President Truman found out what was happening. He went crazy when he heard this, and he told the British in no uncertain terms, this is out of the question. We cannot possibly tolerate the idea here in the modern age of 1950s that Britain will send troops to invade a third world country. This is out of the question. We cannot support it. So this shocked the British. They decided on Plan B. And that plan was they would go to the United Nations, which was then an institution completely responsive to the big powers, and file a resolution, which they would submit for the endorsement of the Security Council, ordering Mossadegh to return the oil company to its British owners. Now, the Americans in the Truman administration tried in a friendly way to warn the British that maybe this wasn't such a good idea, that maybe when the world heard the British case and the Iranian case, they might not be all sympathetic with the British. But the British, caught up in the colonial mentality that had guided them for so long, brushed aside these protests. They, I think, honestly believed that once the world saw how benevolent and how helpful and how friendly the British had been in Iran, they would naturally embrace the British cause and brush aside the foolish, maniacal desire of this elderly lunatic to nationalize the oil company. Well, things happened just the way the Americans had predicted. When Mossadegh found out that this resolution had been filed at the United Nations and that the British were going to try to use this mechanism to take back their oil company, not only was he not displeased, but he decided that he would personally fly to New York to present the Iranian case. He did this, and he made a tremendous impression in New York. He delivered extremely eloquent speeches at the Security Council, some of which I quote at some length in my book. After his presentation, the Security Council was so impressed that it rejected, really for the first time in the history of the UN, a proposal from one of the big powers. And of course, in classic diplomatic fashion, you know, the UN never decides anything yes or no. They did not disapprove the British resolution, but they approved a resolution that called for the postponement of this question until a certain date or indefinitely. Wonderful diplomatic phrase. Okay, that plan didn't work either. Now the British are going on to Plan C. You can't invade. The UN will not help you. Fine. We'll arrange a coup. We'll overthrow Mossadegh, and we'll put someone in who will be friendly and will give us back our oil company. The problem was that Iran in those days, very much like Iran today, actually, for a country of many millions, is actually a very small town. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And when British agents started contacting Iranian officers and Iranian politicians to help them in their coup, Mossadegh immediately got news of this. He did the only thing that he could have done to protect himself. He closed the British embassy. He sent all the British diplomats home, and among them were all the secret agents who were going to plan the coup. So now the British were really in a fix. They had lost their oil company, which was really the foundation of their entire economic prosperity. They could not invade. The United Nations had not supported them, and now they couldn't even overthrow the guy who was tormenting them. They were stymied, and they were tremendously frustrated. In November of 1952, a huge surge of excitement charged through the British Foreign Office and the Secret Service with the news from America that a new administration had been elected in the United States. It was the election of Eisenhower, the change of government in the United States, that electrified the British and made them think, maybe we can get this done after all. They had appealed to President Truman to organize a coup for them. But President Truman had refused. He told them, the CIA has never overthrown a government. This is not what the CIA is about. This is not what the CIA is for. The United States doesn't want to go off in this direction. We don't want to set this precedent. But the Eisenhower administration and the officials who were about to take office, particularly John Foster Dulles, who would be the incoming Secretary of State, and his brother Allen, who was the incoming CIA director, had a very different view of the world. Truman and Eisenhower really had the same assessment of the communist threat. They both took it extremely seriously. But where Truman and Eisenhower differed was how they decided to confront this threat. Truman's idea, as expressed by his brilliant Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, was that the United States should show the nationalists in Asia and Africa and Latin America that the United States was their true friend. His idea was that Americans should embrace the anti-colonialist nationalist ideology that was emerging throughout these parts of the world. That fell by the wayside when Eisenhower took office. Richard Nixon, who was Eisenhower's vice president, of course, had accused the previous administration of enrolling the United States in what Nixon called Dean Acheson's College of Cowardly Communist Containment. As a result, the Dulles brothers were anxious to strike out. They wanted to fight back. But who could they fight back against? It was not possible to bomb Moscow. It was not possible to invade China and try to reverse the outcome of the Civil War there. Who could they strike out against? The British were so excited by the result of the 1952 election that they couldn't even wait until Eisenhower was inaugurated to get their project going. Only a couple of weeks after the election, they sent one of their most senior agents, actually a guy that had been the chief of their intelligence station in Tehran before Mossadegh threw him out, to Washington. His mission was make a presentation to the incoming Eisenhower team, to the Dulles brothers and their associates, and see if you can persuade them to do what Truman refused to do. Overthrow this guy for us.
You're listening to Stephen Kinzer on Iran, the 1953 American coup and the end of democracy. This is Alternative Radio.